This is the Medicast, June 15th, 2007.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters.
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the Medicast, episode 71. I'm Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to this week's show. We've got a lot going on. A lot of exciting things are happening in EMS and in the blogosphere and among podcasters, and it's all exciting work for EMS here on what's been going on, and I'll talk a little bit about that here shortly. But for anybody that's picking up the show for the first time, I want to welcome you to the Medicast. Check out the show, check out some back episodes, check out the website over at medicast.com. All of these things are part of the Medicast community. And if you have something you'd like to share with the rest of us, go ahead and send me an email or comment on the blog. And all of these things help us share information together and make sure we get the best possible accurate information out each and every week. And of course, if you're a long-term listener of this show, thanks for coming back. Thanks for your support, your comments, your emails and calls. All of these are what make the Medicast what it is, and I appreciate it. I got an email from listener Shay up in Edmonton, Canada, and he was asking a question about the EMS Live podcast, the podcast run by John Bignell and company up there in Canada. And I just wanted to let you know, I talked to John recently. He's got things under control and is really just kind of reorganizing a little bit. And the EMS Live podcast will be back, but they're on a little bit of a hiatus. You know, John's been doing that show for quite some time without much of a break. So I think he's allowed to take a little bit of time off. And in the meantime, I'll keep you guys occupied here at the Medicast. And you can keep checking over at emslive.com. And John will have some more information and stuff up there shortly. But I appreciate you sending me the question, Shay. And if you have anything else to offer about EMS in Canada, don't hesitate to drop me a line. I also got a link from listener David, who sent me a link that I'll be touching on a little bit later on in the news. It has to do with a woman dying in a Los Angeles emergency room while people around her tried to call 911 to get her attention. And I'll talk about that a little bit later on. David, thank you for sending me that link. Don't just assume, folks, that I've gotten these information. I actually found this link in a couple of different places, but I definitely appreciate David sending me this link because this is the way that I can make sure that I'm covering the news that's important to you guys. So certainly I do appreciate it. His comment about that is sometimes we find needy patients in the hallways at the ER, and you could spend hours attending to them. I have to agree with that, David, and thanks again for taking the time to send me this link. I got many other great comments back on the Medicast Live episode that was recorded this past Tuesday night, where we talked about precepting and the roles and responsibilities of the instructor and students during the course of clinicals. And just want to thank everybody for their comments. There was just a lot of comments about that show and how much they appreciated it. You can check out that show in the feed. You've probably already gotten it. And if not, make sure you go back and pick it up. It's just a ton of great information. We were blessed to have a couple of really great people on to share their experiences. Peter Canning was there from the Street Watch Notes of a Paramedic blog. Rick Rosati from the Mitigation Journal podcast was on as well. And on top of that, we had two people in the midst of their precepting and clinicals at this time, and they shared with us as well. And I want to thank Chance and With for sharing their experiences with the listeners. So if you want to learn a little bit about what other services are doing and some ideas that they like and don't like from both sides of the fence, head on over and listen to that. You can find a link to it on the website, or if you have the subscription feed from either iTunes or some other download service, you can go ahead and link to it directly in there and get it downloaded if you didn't pick it up automatically. Okay, time to jump right on into this week's news. And I'll start off with the link to the story that came up from listener Dave about the woman in an ER in Los Angeles. She was bleeding in the emergency room on the floor of an inner city hospital, and she died after 911 dispatchers refused to contact paramedics or an ambulance to take her to another facility. There have been tapes released of this call, and apparently this woman died from a perforated bowel back on May 9th at the Martin Luther King Harbor Hospital. Her death was ruled accidental by the coroner's office. However, relatives are very upset, saying she was bleeding from the mouth, writhing in pain for 45 minutes while she sat in the hospital waiting area. And certainly many experts are saying she could have been treated early and survived, certainly, from this if she'd been treated aggressively by the hospital. However, there's a focus on 911 dispatchers and on the dispatch of paramedics and an ambulance to take her to a different hospital. And I think we all know where that's going. It just doesn't make any sense for us to have forwarded an ambulance to take someone out of one hospital and into another. Once we drop these patients off, they really are the hospital's problem. Now, we did not deliver this person to the hospital. She was a walk-in emergency room patient, but it just is kind of shocking. One thing that I think they don't say in this article, and I wish they did, was to focus more on some of the things that are in the background about this. I mean, this is a tragedy. There's no way around that. But I have to wonder if there's any real understanding on the part of the public of the real cause for this, that our ERs are more and more overcrowded and we are unable to really treat all the patients that come in a timely fashion because of the sheer numbers of people that use the emergency room as their primary care physician because they don't have another healthcare provider to turn to. And this is a problem in the healthcare system in this country. It is not a problem of just one hospital. This could have happened in a hospital in my own area or in your own backyard. And you know what hospitals get to be like when they're completely crowded and there's people stacked up in the waiting room. Now, maybe they would have been able to get attention to some kind of a healthcare provider in the back to come out and reevaluate this woman or evaluate her for the first time. This is just not an isolated incident. It's a tragedy that happened, but I think it happened as a result of some underlying issues in the national picture, not just this one hospital. The next item in the news is one I found over at gems.com, and it is an article from the Kennebec, Maine Journal, and is about per diem paramedics floating among several jobs. And this is just a look at something we all know all about, that EMS personnel are working between 60 and 80 hours a week just to make ends meet, that they can't do it in a 40-hour-a-week full-time job, that most of us end up picking up additional shifts at other jobs part-time on a per diem basis, per diem meaning basically that we work without extra benefits, that we're part-time employees. And this article is interesting because one of the comments made by one of the people interviewed said basically people in EMS are like gypsies. It's very unusual to find someone who does not have more than one job or more than one employer. So this is something that I think needs to get out into the public more, and we need to really make people more aware of. You know, last week in my interview with Claiborne over her time dealing with government officials when she was taken to Washington, D.C. to kind of talk about issues important to her, to her elected officials, we talked about trying to get the word out to people in the public domain to let them know about some of the issues that we face. And I think this is one of those things we can really talk about. Maybe you have a reporter you know that you see on ambulance accident scenes very frequently. Maybe you can say something to them about, you know what, I think that maybe you guys could do a story about the fact that we can't make a decent wage and yet we are out here doing this kind of work and this is the kind of work we do. You might be surprised that your local paper would jump on that kind of a story because it is a story that is important to the public for the public to know, and yet many people don't know that. So I urge you to take a look at this particular article. It's a good look at something we all know about, but maybe we can link to it if you have a way to print this out. And hey, you know, go over and put it up on the bulletin board at the supermarket, or put this article printed out over at, you know, the pharmacy or someplace else that has a public bulletin board. Maybe somebody will read it, or show it to a local reporter and say, you know what, you should do a story like this. So anyway, I'll leave it at that, and you can take a look at the link in the show notes. This next article strikes close to home, I think, to all of us, because it has to do with the life and death of our colleagues that fly in helicopter ambulance transport or fixed-wing ambulance transport. I cover these accidents quite frequently in the news for the Medicast, and it's because we need to be aware when other members of our service die. The sister of a flight nurse who died back in 2005 in a helicopter accident in Puget Sound is now trying to get a bill through Congress to tighten down the rules from the FAA on emergency medical transport services that fly. And I think this is something that I think is way overdue. You know, in the name of emergency transport, some of these services are able to bend the rules and or set their own rules based upon the each situation. And unfortunately, this doesn't do much for people that are trying to do their job in a safe environment and get patients the help they need. And this has been a concern I've had for some time. I've been in a position where I've been offered to perhaps when I'm finished my nursing program, move into the job of a flight nurse because of my paramedic experience. And you know, I gotta tell you that I'm not all that excited about doing it based on the flight safety record of EMS ambulance, air ambulance transport here in the United States. And the studies that are out there back that up. A study last year by Johns Hopkins University School of Public Health found that helicopter emergency medical crews are 16 times more likely to die from job-related injuries than the average U.S. worker. And a separate study last year by the National Transportation Safety Board found that most fatal accidents involving medical helicopters occur without a patient on board because the rules are much more relaxed when there is no patient on board. And I think this is what happens. I mean, this is all about money. And these services fly often when there's weather, questionable weather situations. These services are encouraged to fly their helicopters because it's more money for the company. And so the proposed things that the sister, Ms. Friedman, is advocating is stricter regulations, including the requirement to install a computerized warning system to alert pilots when they're too close to dangerous terrain or obstacles, and to mandate voice and flight data recorders that are not mandated now in order to aid accident investigations. Now, the industry, of course, opposes this because it's going to cost them more money, but that's what it comes down to. They're trying to say that if you impose this type of restrictions, that they will not be able to operate the planes that they have and people will go without the life-saving treatment that they get. But let's be honest here. These services, I think, in many cases are operated by hospitals who are trying to get more patients through their facility so that they can bill the patient for the services. And the helicopter is part of that billing process. And these helicopter flights are not cheap and are quite expensive. And I think that, you know what, there needs to be some more oversight here. I think that we're not going to eliminate these kind of accidents. Plane crashes and helicopter crashes do happen. But I don't hear about as many other type of vehicle crashes, air vehicle crashes, as frequently as I do about medevac helicopter and fixed wing crashes. So I feel a little strongly about this. I'm certainly not inclined to go into a local private service to fly helicopters and medevac because I quite honestly don't think that they have the safety background, at least in what I've read and all the things that I cover, there isn't the safety background there to protect me in case of a questionable flight situation. So I'm sure I'm going to get some emails back on this, and you may feel free to do so. If you disagree with me or you have your own idea and take on this, please let me know. I will share everything you send to me on the website and here on the podcast. So this is not a one-sided discussion, folks. If you disagree with me, I'd like to know about it. Maybe you can change my mind about this. But right now, this particular woman's move to improve regulations seems to be a move in the right direction. Finally, I'm going to wrap up with an article here that has to do a little bit more with the public health front, but it has to do with the parents of a 12-year-old girl who has autism, and her parents have been granted a day in federal court, basically their chance to pitch their case or have their attorney pitch their case that their child's autism was caused by being vaccinated with a vaccine containing a mercury derivative. And this precedent-setting case could pave the way for thousands of autistic children to receive compensation from the government fund to set up to help people injured by flu by vaccinations. Now, this is something that I think a lot of people don't understand. You know, there's the word out there to some parents that autism can be caused by certain vaccines that their children receive. And this dates back many years to the mid to late 80s and into the 90s, where these vaccines usually carried a product or a preservative called thimerosal. Thimerosal was a mercury derivative. It contained very minute amounts of mercury, but it was found to restrict the growth of microorganisms in the vaccine vials. And because these vaccines were given to children earlier in the time of administering vaccines, back in the early part of the 20th century, in the 1920s and 30s, it was found that when you gave vaccinations to children, if you didn't have some kind of a preservative in there to inhibit the growth of microorganisms, you ended up injecting them with things like a staph infection. And they died, or certain numbers of them died from the staph infection soon after they were injected with the vaccine that was supposed to save their life. So things like thimerosal were come up with. And it has been out there. It was tested. It was found to be very, very low in dose. But the concern came about back in the late 80s and early 90s that because of the number of vaccines given to children at a very young age, that there was a combining effect, I guess is what I want to say, that the amount of mercury actually added up faster than they could get rid of it, and it wasn't something that was safe for the children. I'm going to talk a little bit more about thimerosal and exactly what it is later on in the podcast as the Med of the Week, because I think this is something we need to understand, because we are a first line of medical care for many people, and we need to have a good understanding of the science behind this. So I'm going to be dealing with two different topics for the rest of the Medicast today. For the tip and trick of the week, I'm going to be talking about autism and dealing with autistic patients. So we'll get a basis of what autism is and when signs and symptoms of autism may first present in a child that is autistic. And then in the Med of the Week, I'm going to be talking a little bit more in depth about thimerosal and the studies and science out there that are looking at the possibility that there may be a link. And so I want you to stay tuned and educate yourselves, because this is what it comes down to. These vaccines that may or may not contain any thimerosal at all anymore are the vaccines that protect children from life-threatening diseases. And if the word gets out there that children shouldn't be vaccinated and parents start signing off refusing to have their children vaccinated, we're going to go back to a time when children died from getting the measles and children died from getting whooping cough and the mumps. These are serious childhood illnesses that if you ask your grandparents if they knew anybody when they were children that died from these diseases, the chances are reasonable that you're going to find out that they know someone or remember someone who did, because these vaccines made a huge difference to a time when parents regularly expected to lose a child before they were 10 years old, And these vaccines changed the world because the parents in the United States no longer expected to have one of their children die. And now look at the parents. They're so complacent about the fact that their children are safe because they don't understand and haven't seen the effects of these horrible diseases on children that they think they can get away without having a vaccine. And that may be true for one or two children here or there because of what's called herd immunity. Herd immunity is the immunity that you get because everyone else around you is immune to the disease, that you end up not being able to catch it from anybody, even if you're not immune. But herd immunity only goes so far because eventually, if enough people decide they shouldn't be getting their kids vaccinated, these diseases will start to crop up again very quickly. There are only a few reported cases of each disease in the United States every year, but that will change rapidly if the vaccine program out there is let to fall to circumstantial evidence based on questionable science. So we're going to talk a little bit more about that later. This is something I feel very strongly about. This is going to lead me right on into this week's tip and trick of the week, and that's going to be to focus a little bit on dealing specifically with autistic patients. They do have special needs, and if you have a patient who is autistic and there's not a caregiver around to give you some advice on the best ways to deal with them, you may be at a loss on how to handle this patient. And you may be doing some things wrong that cause a rough situation to become even rougher. But first, let's start off with what exactly is autism. Autism is a lifelong neurological disorder that disrupts a child's learning, socialization, communication, and decision-making skills. This disorder falls under the medical diagnosis of pervasive developmental disorder. And there are five basic areas that you may also hear diagnosed when someone tells you of somebody's medical history. They may be listed as having autism, Asperger's syndrome, childhood disintegrative disorder, Rett's disorder, and also PDD-NOS, pervasive developmental disorder. So you need to kind of be aware that some of these other terms are out there and that they mean essentially that the child or the person is autistic. It's important to understand what autism is not as much as it is important to understand what it is. It is not mental retardation, it is not emotional disorder, and it is not the result of poor parenting. It is one of the number one disabilities in this country, currently ranked third. It is a rapidly growing segment of the population, and it affects every sector of society. It is increasingly being diagnosed, and this is one of the reasons that autism is becoming so much more prevalent, not because of any causal relationship between anything, but because they're getting better tools to diagnose autism and understand more of what's going on in childhood development at an earlier age. Some of the things that you might want to look for when you have a patient that you're wondering if they are autistic and it may clue you in is that they avoid making eye contact. They prefer to be alone and left alone. They have difficulty expressing specifically what their needs are, and they insist on routine or sameness. They have an inappropriate sensory response. This means that they are susceptible to pain from what you might anticipate is just a light touch. So you need to be aware that their sensory perception is skewed, and they may be more sensitive to light or noise or touch on the skin. They may also and will likely have difficulty interacting with others, and they have no real fear of danger because they lack some of the understanding of the activities they are performing are dangerous. So autistic children are more prone to falls because they tend to not have that fear that younger children have about climbing to high places, you know, the visual cliff idea that, you know, you might see an autistic child walking along the top of a split rail fence without blinking an eye because they don't understand that what they're doing is inherently dangerous. In some cases, not just that they have altered sensitivity to stimulation, they may also be insensitive to pain. So they may feel more sensitivity in some sensory realms, but be unable to sense pain when they injure themselves. And so you need to look for this as well. They may avoid being touched, and you may see sustained unusual repetitive motions or skills. You may see them rocking, or you may see them moving their hands repetitively in a certain motion. These may be clues to you that when they're excited or upset, this may be something that they do subconsciously. They will usually have uneven physical skills, uneven or missing verbal skills. They may also have inappropriate laughing or giggling or inappropriate attachment to objects. And this is important to understand. Because they don't like to be touched or don't like to be bothered with, the worst thing you can do with a person with autism is try to restrain them. Often, if you come into a situation where the person is being restrained by police officers and the like, you may be able to calm the situation down by getting the people that are attempting to restrain the person to leave. Remember, this person may have an insensitivity to pain. They may be injuring themselves because they are overpowering four or five people trying to hold them down. And they are causing themselves injury because they are unable to feel the pain of trying to fight off people restraining them. Sometimes if you can get the if you get the people restraining them out of the room, they visualize them as attackers and sit back and calmly talk to the person using their name and asking them what's going on and trying to communicate with them, you may be able to calm them down from across the room. And then you may be able to convince them to walk with you out to the ambulance. The causes of autism are generally to be thought to be at least partially genetic and may be some people may have a predisposition to autism and it is triggered by some portion of their environment. I will talk a little bit later about the supposed link between vaccines and vaccine preservatives in autism, but there may be other things going on, but generally it is thought to be a mechanical problem in the brain, something that isn't being produced or isn't connected quite in the appropriate manner that it is supposed to be. But these people are intelligent, thinking people. They just have a difficulty communicating with their environment, either physically or verbally or emotionally. And so if you understand this, you can use that to help you treat the person appropriately. The most important thing to remember when dealing with one of these patients is to understand that it's important to recognize autism for what it is early on in the game. And then once you do, you can try to change your assessment rules. You know, we talk about dealing with children and starting, instead of going head to toe, going toe to head. And this is a perfect example of someone you may have to do that with, even if they're a teenager or a young adult. And it's because they don't like to be touched, and you need to talk to them. You need to prepare them for what you're going to do. You need to let them know that you need to look at their injury, that you're going to look at their injury and you're going to put a piece of gauze on it. You explain everything you do, and you do it slowly and calmly, and you let them know what's going on before you do it. That way, they are prepared. And you can ask them if there's any particular way they would like to do something. Now, here's what I would suggest to you. This is one of those things that parents of young children will get right away. Give them a choice, but give them not the choice of yes or no, but the choice of yes number one or yes number two. In other words, if you need them to get into the ambulance, you ask them, would you like us to put you on the cot and put your seatbelt on out here, or would you like to climb into the ambulance and we can put your seatbelt on in the ambulance? They may not want to be sitting on the cot with the multiple seatbelts on. You may have to compromise and put them on the bench seat in a seatbelt or in the captain's chair in a seatbelt so that they are more used to sitting in that type of situation. You're going to have to adjust the way you do things a little bit. You need to really work hard to manage their anxiety, and you need to communicate with them about where they're going and what's going on and let them know exactly what you're doing as you do it, as I said earlier. So this is really a broad spectrum disorder that affects a large number of our population and is often thought to be something else, either somebody who's on drugs or somebody who has other problems. And if you look for some of the telltale characteristics, the inability to make eye contact, the repetitive motions, the inability to effectively communicate, all these things may add up to you getting an idea that something different is going on, and you will be able to change your treatment and better handle exactly what's going on with this given patient. Sometimes it's just somebody who's lost and needs a ride home. They don't necessarily need to go to the hospital. They just need to have somebody contact their family member or caregiver and get them back to where they belong. It's not an emotional disorder call. It's an autistic person who's lost. So I hope this has helped you understand. I'm going to be posting up over the coming weeks some more information on the website, tips and tricks for first responders to calls with autistic patients. And as I do so, you'll be able to see that show up on the Medicast website at medicast.com. Tonight for the Med of the Week, I'm going to be looking at thimerosal, which is the preservative that was found in vaccines that has been linked, at least by some people, to be a possible cause of autism in young children. So let's go back and look a little bit at thimerosal and get some of the facts. Thimerosal is a mercury-containing organic compound, also known as an organomercurial. It has been produced since the 1930s and used widely as a preservative in a number of biological and drug products, including many vaccines. And this has been done to help prevent life-threatening contamination by harmful microbes. This dates back to a study back in 1928, and this is from Australia, and in early stages of an immunization campaign against diphtheria, a Dr. George Thompson, who was a medical officer of health in Bundaberg, began an injection of children with a toxin-antitoxin mixture in order to vaccinate them. The material was taken from a container and was given to them in a multi-dose injection to each child from a single container. The first group of 21 children got the injection without any ill effect. 7 days later, they went ahead and injected another 21 children. Of these, 11 died soon after, and another one died the day after, soon after that. So 12 children out of the 21 died following the injection. It was investigated, and the commission found that the deaths were caused by an injection of live staphylococci bacteria into the patients as a result of infection and transmission from the multi-dose container of the vaccine. At that time, they began adding preservatives to the vaccines, and thimerosal was the one that seemed to meet the requirements for a preservative set forth by scientists. It seemed to have a good effect on preventing the growth of microorganisms and fungi in medical dosages and in concentrations as low as 0.001% of thimerosal to 0.01% thimerosal. This is extremely small amounts, one part in 10,000 or one part in 100,000. So a vaccine containing a 0.01% thimerosal as a preservative contains 50 micrograms of thimerosal per 0.5 ml dose, or approximately 25 micrograms of mercury per half ml dose. So what happened recently? Why did this suddenly become an issue? Well, part of the reason is, and it's speculated, that because most aspects or beginning aspects of autism are diagnosed around 18 months of age as some of the developmental delays start to show up, and many children are vaccinated with the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine at 12 to 15 months, the parents seem to see a change in the way their child was developing soon after they got this vaccine, within a few months, and they began to wonder if this was a causal relationship. So the FDA began actively addressing this issue in 1997, where they conducted a review of the use of thimerosal in vaccines, And when this review was conducted in 99, they found no evidence of harm from the use of thimerosal in a vaccine, other than local hypersensitivity reactions at the site of injection. However, they did urge and put out an order to start reducing the amount of mercury in certain vaccines and as soon as possible, and this went out to the manufacturers of these vaccines. This was a precautionary measure put out by the Public Health Service, including the FDA, the NIH, and the CDC. And what they did was they issued two different statements. The first urging manufacturers to reduce or eliminate thimerosal as soon as possible in 1999 and in 2000. And again, they collaborated with various investigators to initiate further study of this. It's important to note that while the diagnosis of autism has continued to rise in recent years, this rise in diagnosis of autism in young children happened after the removal of thimerosal from almost all vaccines given to young children. So the increase in the amount of autism cases being reported by pediatricians has little to do with thimerosal and vaccines at this time. So the concern about thimerosal really has to do with the predated evidence of whether children who got the vaccine prior to 2000, 2001, who presented with autism at that time or soon after. Several studies were undertaken to look at the links between thimerosal and autism. And it was one of the preliminary results of one study indicated that there was no change in autism rates relative to the amount of thimerosal a child received during the first 6 months of life. And a weak association was found in one study between thimerosal intake and certain neurodevelopmental disorders like ADD and ADHD. But this was only in one study, and in a subsequent study, that link was found to be not there. So it's unsure why this causal link may have been found. But it was a very weak link and was just a possibility. In 2001, the Institute of Medicine convened a committee that reviewed many of these studies, and they looked at two different areas to review. The first review focused on a potential link between autism and the combined measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, and the second review focused on a relationship between thimerosal use in all vaccines and all neurodevelopmental disorders. This later issue was brought to force primarily as a result of the hypothesis from a Cure Autism Now novel that came out talking about mercury poisoning. The hypothesis linking autism to mercury was based on a comprehensive review of scientific literature on mercury toxicity. But in 2004, the Immunization Safety Review Committee issued a final report examining the hypothesis that vaccines, specifically the MMR and thimerosal vaccines, may have causally associated with autism. In this report, the committee incorporated evidence from the United States, Denmark, Sweden, and the United Kingdom, and they looked at all the biological mechanisms related to vaccines and autism since the report began. They concluded that the body of evidence favors a rejection of a causal relationship between thimerosal-containing vaccines and autism, and that hypotheses generated to date concerning a biological mechanism for such causality are theoretical only. Furthermore, the committee stated that the benefits of the vaccination itself are proven, and the hypothesis of susceptible population is just speculative at this time. Widespread rejection of vaccines, however, would lead to increases in the incidences of serious infectious diseases, currently largely under control in the United States. So this is science speak, and people often don't understand that scientists rarely speak in absolutes. Because of the way data presents, they are unwilling to come out and say this does not have a causal relationship. However, saying that they do not see a causal relationship or that the evidence favors rejection of a causal relationship is pretty much as strong as you're going to get out of any kind of scientific study or review. And this is why the fact that people are looking for some reason for their children's illness is so difficult. I understand, I have children of my own, and I understand the need to find a reason for what's going on with your child. And autism certainly can be devastating to a family in many ways. But I think that the evidence seems to be pretty clear, at least from so far, that there is not a real link between the two. So I hope that the parents are able to move on and get an understanding of what's going on with their child's illness. But at the same time, we as medical practitioners and medical providers, okay, in the field, need to be proactive in educating ourselves and the public about what this really means. First of all, there is no thimerosal in almost all vaccines, and only a small amount in, I believe, one of the hepatitis vaccines. There is very, very minute amounts present in that one vaccine. So this means that the thought that vaccines cause autism is no longer a valid one, because there is no mercury, or extremely low amounts when compared to before, of mercury in any of the vaccines. And therefore, there is no causal link between vaccines now and autism. And so we need to educate people that vaccines really save lives, and that they don't want their child to get sick, and that the vaccine is going to be there to help their child stay well and not cause them any injury. And that's where we, on the front lines of medicine, can do the most good, by educating people. When we have young patients, ask the parents, have they had their vaccinations? And if you do get a reaction that vaccinations are bad, you can at least relay a little bit of information about the fact that that data presents differently, that you can teach them that that's just not the case. Again, this is a situation where we can reinforce what they're hearing from other healthcare providers. And that, folks, is going to wrap up this week's episode of the Medicast. I want to thank all of you for joining the show and listening to everything. I hope you've been able to educate yourselves a little bit about a topic that is sometimes a little difficult to wrap your brains around, but I think it's important to understand both the autistic patient and some of the facts surrounding the causes of autism. If you have any information or comments that you'd like to share with me or the other Medicast listeners, you can reach me here at podmedic@mac.com. And you can also call me over at the voicemail line for the Medicast at 941-306-3342. That's 941-30-MEDIC. You can always leave comments on the website, and each blog entry, there's a spot at the bottom where you can click and leave a comment about the show or about the posting. And I certainly appreciate when you do that. And if it's the first time you do so, I will get an email about it so that I can approve it and get it up on the website. But after your first input is approved, your other subsequent posts will get put up right away. So you get an opportunity to share your information and comments directly with the Medicast listeners that way as well. I'll close out this week's show, as I always do, with some great PodSafe music. This week from the PodSafe Music Network over at music.podshow.com. This week I have a repeat artist here from the Medicast, Sophia Ramos, with her song Esperanza. If you like what you hear, you can go over and check the link in the show notes. Let the artists know that you heard their song here on the Medicast. And if you like what you hear, you can also click the button there. It'll take you over to iTunes, and you can purchase the song if you like what you're listening to. Either way, without further ado, let's get into the music. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. Until next time, scene safety. BSI.